Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we featured DeRay McKesson in conversation with Loretta Charlton. McKesson was working in public education in Minneapolis in 2014 when protests erupted in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson after police fatally shot an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown. McKesson drove to Ferguson to join the protests, intending to stay for a week. Instead, he remained on the ground organizing in Ferguson for 400 days. The Ferguson protests would build into the Black Lives Matter movement, and McKesson would commit himself to full-time activism. Since then, he's become someone the New York Times declared as, quote, one of the most recognizable civil rights figures of the social media age. McKesson joined Literary Arts on the occasion of the publication of On the Other Side of Freedom, which is a call to action, a guidebook for activists, and a personal memoir. Loretta Charlton joined McKesson for an onstage conversation. Charlton is an editor on the national desk at the New York Times, where she edits Race Related, a weekly newsletter featuring stories about race from all over the newsroom. Their conversation ranges from the work McKesson has done as a community organizer, to the national headlines he has made, to the controversies around his work, and many personal details from his childhood that have shaped him as an activist and as a citizen. Here's McKesson.
I appreciate you guys. Stop it. I gotta talk. Oh, that's so sweet.
It is good to be back. It's good to be in conversation with Loretta. It's good to be in community with you. And it's always good to talk about how we make the world a better place. Before we start this conversation about the book, there are three things on my heart that I wanted to share. The first is, you know, we were in the street for a long time. So if you ever saw us marching in 2014, it wasn't that we thought marching was a cool thing. It was illegal to stand still in August, September, and October of 2014, that if we stood still for more than 5 seconds, we were arrested. And I think about that often because I also think about this chant that we said, a chant that you are probably familiar with. And that was, no justice, no peace. And we said, no justice, no peace, every day and every night, because we understood it as a statement of fact. Some people thought it was a threat, but we knew that it was just a true statement, that any call for peace not rooted in a demand for justice was something we didn't want. We knew that the freedom that our lives deserve would never be rooted in something as basic as order and compliance. And we knew that a call for peace in the absence of justice was just a call for order and compliance. And what we knew to be true then is something we know to be true now. No justice, no peace. We want a justice that we can feel and touch and see and hear, a justice that makes people bigger, a justice that allows people to be the full people that they are and show up in the fullness of who they are every day. We want a justice that says Mike Brown is coming home today. We want a justice that says Tamir Rice is playing in the backyard and that Rakia is at another cookout. We want a justice that is a living, breathing justice. We don't want the abstract stuff because we live real lives. And when we think about the difference between justice and accountability, the accountability is what happens after the trauma. Justice is the fact that you should never have to experience a trauma in the first place. And we want this justice everywhere. We want it in our bedrooms, our boardrooms, the classrooms, the courtrooms, the suites, and the streets. Because we know that the statement social justice is almost redundant in so many ways, that there is no justice that isn't social, that justice is always about how we are in community with each other. So when we say no justice, no peace, that is also a call to action. It's a reminder that we take this understanding into everything that we do. I think about it in my work as a teacher. I taught sixth grade math and I love sixth grade. Sixth grade is everything. Sixth graders are great. Sixth graders still believe in magic. You know, that's why sixth grade is so beautiful. Seventh grade is puberty and deodorant and it's rough. But sixth grade is like still a lot of joy. You know, I can walk into sixth grade classrooms and be like, everybody's a math magician. And they're like, yes. Seventh graders are like, why are you yelling? And you're like, okay. Seventh graders also, like, every time I think about seventh grade, I'm like, who made Axe Spray? Why did you make Axe Spray? But I say that because, you know, I taught 60, 90, and 120-minute classes, which is a whole lot of math to teach 11-year-olds. And I'll never forget, one day my students were like, Mr. McKesson, can we go to gym early? And I was like, you sure can, because I'm tired of you and you tired of me. So have fun at gym. And I'll never forget that they came back really quickly. And I was like, why are you back so quick? And what I realized is that they were in love with the idea of gym more than the work of gym. And I say that because in this moment, there's some people more in love with the idea of resistance than the work of resistance. And when I think about why I wrote the book, it was a question for me about what does the work look and sound like? And I listened to this sermon not too long ago, and the sermon was called Don't Tell Your Story Too Soon. And I'll never forget it because the title was, I was like, I gotta listen to this. Don't tell you, that's a good title. And what he says is that sometimes you can tell your story so soon, all you see is the pain and not the purpose. And if I had written a book 3 years ago, it would have been about the pain of protest. I knew that all too well. I knew what it was like to hide under my steering wheel. I knew what it was like to run from pepper spray and tear gas and rubber bullets. I knew how that was different in Charleston and McKinney and Portland and Baltimore and Ferguson. But I didn't yet have the language to talk about the lessons that I learned and the most important experiences. But I do now, and that's why I wrote a book. So I'm excited for you to be here, I'm excited to be here myself, and I'm excited to be in conversation. Let's do it.
Thank you, DeRay. Congratulations on writing your first book. It's a true accomplishment.
It almost killed me, so I'm happy it's done.
And one of the things I thought while reading is that it's really timely, in fact. Ferguson was 4 years ago, but you know, I watched the trailer the other day for The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. And I mean, it's really incredible because we're now starting to see mainstream narratives of young people becoming radicalized. For those of you who don't know about it, the book, it's the story of a young girl who goes to a posh private school, and she witnesses her friend being shot and killed by police. And Ferguson was this moment of transformation for you, and we're starting to see these moments of transformations for young people, and there's so many young people here. So I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about that transformation in Ferguson and sort of what you're seeing young people experience today.
Yeah, I was at Grant High School today, and one of the things I said to them was that, you know, for all the celebrities that are activists now and for all these people with a lot of access and resources, the people who were in the street in the early days, it was high schoolers. Like, I remember I got to St. Louis on August 16th. The 17th was the first night that I was ever tear gassed, and it was wild. And it was, you know, and tear gas has no color. So if you've ever seen it on TV, it looks like smoke to you. That lasts for like all of 12 seconds, and then it's like just clear, and you can feel it, but you can't see it. So there's a lot of tear gas at night, and I got split up, and I got stuck in this group, and it was a group of high school boys. Like, they were the people, we were hopping fences together, like, we were just out there, you know? It was high schoolers who were willing to put everything on the line in those early days, and I'm always reminded of that. The beauty of the movement is, like, people did it, right? Like, people just came outside and were like, we're not gonna do this no more, and just stayed outside for 400 days, and that was really powerful. When I think about my own transformation, you know, I had spent a career in education, so I taught sixth grade math, I opened up an after-school center. I worked in human capital in Baltimore and Minneapolis. And when I saw that Mike Brown had been killed, it was this thing about, like, if I say that I believe in kids, the least I can do is, like, stand in the middle of the street for a weekend. Like, that was, like, the least I could do. That, like, they killed a teenager, I can go stand in the street. And then when I got to St. Louis, I was like, I just got tear gas. That's wild. Like, and we can't stand still. This is, like, so wild. I'll do whatever I can to make sure people never have to experience that. And that was sort of the moment for me. And what was beautiful about then was that, like, we all sort of figured out how to come together. Like, there was no organization leading the protest. There was, like, this deep infrastructure, though. And I look back on that time fondly, that like what you didn't see on TV was like the woman who came out every night and made like hot dogs and hamburgers for people on the corner. Like you didn't see her, we knew her, y'all didn't see her. Or, like you didn't see the people who would like at home, they would buy pizzas and they just order them to intersections that we were at because like we were starving, you know? And like we didn't have anything to eat, but like all of a sudden 50 pizzas showed up. You're like, pizza, you know, like that was so magical. And I never want to forget that.
So in that moment, you're talking about the sort of anonymous people who are in the streets and sort of forming this coalition and fighting for this movement. And the book, one of the themes that I thought was really interesting is this question of authenticity and whether or not there's a right or wrong way to participate, because you mentioned things like, you know, radicalism without vision and gatekeeping in the activist community that we're seeing in some of these more mainstream political conversations as well. There's an interesting part where you talk about going to, I think it was like a training session for protesters, and you didn't find it very like useful for whatever reason. And I wanted you to speak a little bit to the idea that there could possibly be a right or wrong way to participate in social justice.
Yeah, I think about three things come to mind. One is that I never confuse collective action for the work of organizations. That there's some organizations that do a lot of great things, there's some organizations that are just sort of organizations. And that, like, I'm always mindful that Harriet Tubman didn't have a 501c3 and made an impact, right? That, like, that there's, like, a way to be in the work. And sometimes, like, you need to be a member of something, but sometimes you can, like, be a member in your living room and that's enough, right? That is actually powerful and amazing. The first thing I ever did in protest is I made the best peanut butter and jelly sandwiches you've ever eaten. And, like, that was what I did. And we did it in somebody's living room. And, like, I didn't need to be a card-carrying member of something to do that. Like, we were able to do that. So like that is one thing, is that that's not necessarily a right or wrong, but there's some people who are always waiting to join something, thinking that that's the only way to build power. And again, Harriet Tubman didn't have a 501c3 and like figured out how to make an impact. The second is that there's some people who like only conceive of organizing in ways that we've seen before. And I remember being in the street in St. Louis, we were waiting for somebody to tell us what to do. We were like, somebody's coming, they gonna tell us. And then that didn't happen, right? And like, we were like, oh, I guess we gotta make it up. And like, we had social media, we had these tools that other people didn't have, and we were always experimenting with how to do this. So I think about one night, the police are wild, wilder than any place I've been, but we were trying to shut down this intersection, and we knew that the police were being particularly like violent. So we were like, there was this chant back in the day called, they think it's a game, they think it's a joke. That was like what we chant. They think it's a game, they think it's a joke. And we bought like all these toys and we shut down this intersection playing toys. So it's like 50-year-old white women jump roping. It's like people playing monkey in the middle. And that's how we shut down this intersection. And it was amazing because the police were so mad. You know, like they knew that the picture of them arresting like that old white woman jump roping was just gonna be a bad photo. And we were, you know, we're playing hopscotch. We're like literally in the middle of the street. Like the cars are honking, everything's a mess. And like, they didn't do anything because they knew that that was gonna be bad and we knew it was gonna be bad. And it was like, that's those sort of things that we like made up in the middle of the night where like, we needed the freedom to do that. The third thing is that people often think about authenticity as people's proximity to trauma. And like, I think about authenticity as people's proximity to work. I know a lot of people who have been traumatized, who have no idea what solutions should look like, who've not thought about like how to fix the problem, but they do have real proximity to trauma, that like I'm trying to think about like how do we think about authenticity as people's proximity to work? Like, do you know it well enough to be a part of the solutions in a way that push? Are you interested in knowing it better? Like, that is sort of how I think about this. And I worry about the social justice community sometimes is that we say things like people closest to the problem are closest to the solution, which I get and it sounds right, like it sounds perfect.
You suck!
And really, what I think it is this idea that like, is this notion that like people closest to the problem are actually closest to the problem, right? And that like that is real. And we need to make sure that we help people think about what the solutions look like. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's
okay.
So I want to get back to trauma a little bit later in the conversation, but right now I'm thinking of this iconic image of you. I think it's in Louisiana, you were arrested, and you're wearing a shirt that I think says Stay Woke and the Twitter logo on it. So I want to get to the conversation of the quality of wokeness. And well, you write in the book, too many people claim to be woke, and you've grown tired of the term ally, and now you prefer the term accomplice. And I was hoping you can elaborate on that idea, you know, sort of talking about this transition from wokeness to ally to accomplice and what that sort of looks like and what you mean by that.
Yeah, so that chapter is on the chapter on whiteness, and it's called The Choreography of Whiteness, because I'm always interested in the way that whiteness works and, like, what does that mean and how does that feel and how do we think about it? And I'm mindful, you know, people talk often about truth and reconciliation and don't want to acknowledge that the truth has to come before the reconciliation, right? People want to do the reconciliation work without doing the truth stuff, and, like, there's no way you can't do that. That doesn't work. So the entrance to this, I'll tell a story. I was, and this is not a humble brag, I'm just trying to give you context, is that I was at Miss Tina, Beyonce's mom's, this party, and we love Miss Tina, we love B, but it was a wearable art party, so everybody was, like, wearing a piece of art. And I'm wearing this, like, clear coat thing that has facts about justice, right? So one fact, all of these are true, is that we arrest more people for weed than all violent crimes combined. Another one was that 1 in 5 black men in Florida can't vote. That's true. And the third was that white high school dropouts have more wealth than all black college graduates. So this guy, this is like Miss Tina's party, this guy walks up to me and he's like, DeRay, are these true? And I'm like, they are all true. And he's like, well, I don't know if this wealth one is true. And I'm like, I don't know if you get to say it's not true, right? Like, it's true. And he says to me, he says, DeRay, the reason that white people have more wealth than everybody else is that they're more white people. And I'm like, you know, we're at this party though, so I gotta be like a little chill. So I'm like, the only reason they're more white people is because you killed half the people and enslaved the other half. And he literally is just like shocked, right? And in that moment, I always think about, again, people's unwillingness to deal with, like, the truth of how we got here. And the truth about wealth is that we gave white people wealth, right? We, like, literally gave white people housing loans with 1% interest. We, like, gave people free education. You think about the Highway Administration, is that in Alabama, the White Citizens Council literally took over the Highway Administration and paved over communities that organized the bus boycotts in Montgomery, that, like, we literally gave white people wealth. It's only when you start to talk about people of color and poor people that people suddenly are like, we have no clue what to do with wealth. You're like, we just did it, right? Like, it's only with poor people and people of color that people have no imagination all of a sudden. So you think about this idea of, like, allies and accomplices. Allies love you from a distance. They're like, hope you get free, call me, right? Accomplices love you up close. And accomplices say, like, let me figure out what I can do to aid in the work. Not just hope you get free. And, like, when we think about this conversation about white privilege, is that it's important that white people understand their privilege and understand that they benefit from things that they didn't necessarily do themselves. But that alone isn't enough, right? That, like, that when white people get to that point, they are late to the party, because we had that understanding a long time ago, right? Like, we got that. The thing about that that can be really remarkable is when white people understand that the system allows for the privilege to exist in the first place. Like, that is, like, deep understanding. And then they take that understanding and work to do things at the system level that redistribute resources and, like, help everybody understand how to do the work.
I do want to go back one question and talk about a previous stop on your book tour where it was interrupted, and this idea that the criticism that that your work is somehow profiting off of a grassroots movement. And I thought it would be good for you to speak to that and how you feel about what happened. And
yeah, so here's the thing, I'm a protester. So when people protest, I'm down for it. Like, I get it, right? Like that if you disagree, you know, I'm a protester. So I don't get, you know, I'm sensitive to that. You know, St. Louis is this interesting space. I think that, you know, we were in the street for a long time, and that stop in St. Louis is like, we all know each other. The truth is that like in the movement space, is that the group of people I'm closest to, we've raised $140,000 in 4 years, which is not a lot of money in the nonprofit space. And all of that money we pour back into the big projects we've done. So we created the first public database of police union contracts, the first public database of use of force policies. We've done a lot of big data things and we're still doing them. I think the hard thing is that people often confuse visibility with wealth. So I've been on the news a ton. Let me tell you, being on the news, they send you a car to pick you up and they send you a car to take you home. That's it. I've been on Colbert and The Daily Show and all those things. I'm on in those spaces to try and tell the truth in different ways. You actually don't get paid to do those things. So I think that people have like this deep misconception, and I think that came up that night. I'm always down to talk to people about the way the misconception works up. And the second is around some of the visibility stuff, is that some of it is like we do it really quietly to try and create space for other people. So I think about in Florida, there are 2 million ex-felons in Florida that can't vote. Hopefully they'll get the right to vote in November. That's a big deal. And, you know, because I know a lot of people who have influence, like what we did is we reached out to Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, we got Jay-Z, we got all of them because they were going to be in Florida on tour. We got them to open up the tour venues very quietly so that the petition gatherers who needed 700,000 signatures so they could get petition signatures at the concerts. And it's that sort of stuff that, like, we didn't tweet about. I don't really talk about it because, like, that's not why the work matters. Like, it mattered that they got the petitions. Like, that is what we wanted to happen, and it happened, right? I think a lot of the tension is that. What I will say is I'm sympathetic to, in his complaints there, I don't know about these complaints, is that there is this narrative that has happened in the movement that makes Ferguson seem like a blip on the radar, right? That there are people who now remember 2014 as like a long weekend, and anybody who lived through it knew that it was like a long 400 days, right? These were not a short 400 days. It was like a long, long time. And we can all remember those like dark nights. I remember one night that we thought we had somewhere to stay and we didn't. So we literally pull over on the side of the road. It's freezing. Me and Netta take turns waking up to turn the heat on. You know, it's just like, you didn't see those moments, but the people who lived it, like we all had those, and I'm one of many people. And there is this real frustration in St. Louis that is fair about how the narrative is now that like Ferguson was the logical conclusion of other people's organizing, as opposed to something like special and different and unique that created so much space for everybody else. And like, I'm sympathetic to that. It's why in the book, I do so much work to like say there's so many people that did so much that you'll never know about, right? That Mama Cat made food for people, that if Keith hadn't helped run the bail fund, people would have never gotten out of jail. That I think that part of our work when we have platforms is to lift other people up and to say like, let me acknowledge all the people that the larger space has forgotten, because without them, there is no movement. So I'm sympathetic to those complaints.
Shout out to all the people, those, you know, people on the streets that.
Yeah, shout out to them. And like, you know, one of the hard things about living in public is that like you live in public, and in public there's a lot of feedback, and sometimes it's feedback and sometimes it's noise. But I'm happy to participate in the conversation like when we can, you know, and again, I'm a protester, so like I get that.
You can empathize. So I want to talk about social media and language, a couple things that are they're recurring themes in your book, and sort of wielding the power of both. You write that Twitter saved our lives. I thought that was a very, you know, blunt statement. You also wrote to ignore the role of social media as a difference maker is perilous. And backstage, we were talking about rumors that like trolls said you're funded by Soros and all of these crazy, crazy things. And we also experienced in the last presidential election, you know, interference in social media. So I wanted to hear you speak about how you sort of, how do you parse those two things? Like when we're dealing, when those major tech companies were just not prepared for the kind of interference that we experienced, and your idea that social media is a critical tool that you need to have as a social justice leader.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the good and bad of social media. The first person ever permanently banned from Twitter was banned for raising money to try and get me killed. So I have seen that part of it. I've also, which was not kind, and you know, understatement, I try to be chill about it because so it doesn't freak me out. But, you know, he now has White House press credentials, which is probably the craziest part of that story. And I've seen like the hard parts of what the internet allows. You know, I'll never forget when my phone got hacked. I was like on a panel, and I have two phones, and I'm on a panel, and one of my phones is like, the screen is like, please activate your phone. And I'm like, well, I've never seen that screen before. So I turn my phone off, turn it back on, and it's like, please activate your phone. I'm like, what does that mean? And then I'm like, oh my God, I think I'm being hacked. So on my other phone, I'm texting people being like, is somebody tweeting from my account? And what I realized is that if you have Verizon, the last four digits of your social is like the PIN for your account. So my social got leaked online and somebody called Verizon, they changed my SIM card over the phone and then they reset every account that they knew that I had. So the two-factor code went to a device that they had and not mine. So they got into my Gmail, they got into my Twitter. It was like a whole thing. And what was wilder, I've only started to talk about this in public, I like erased this from my mind, this next part, is that when I finally got my phone back, it was like 6 hours to get control of my phone again, is that I get this text from somebody that's like, hey, DeRay, saw you got hacked. And like a lot of people have my number, so I'm like, thanks for reaching out, who's this? And he's like, a hacker. And I'm like, this is awkward. And he's like, I have advice for you. And I'm like, okay. And then he literally gives me all of my credit card numbers, like he just has them. And I'm like, well, I guess you already, like, I can't hide, right? Like, I guess we're gonna keep talking because you clearly already know what I'm doing. And then he gives me some advice and like that, but like those things, that is like a weird way to be in the public space. I've been sued by 5 officers in 2 states. So in Dallas, when those 5 officers got killed by the police, I'm being sued by 3 of their families. And in Baton Rouge, I'm being sued by, there's an officer that got hit by a rock. I was in jail when he got hit with that rock. And then there was another officer that got hit. And, you know, I'm being sued by him. So I think about, like, what it is like to live in the public space, and, like, those things are allowed to happen because of social media. Like, that creates that. But I've also seen the beauty of finding so many people who, like, are able to tell their story unmitigated by any gatekeeper or anybody else because of the platform. And, like, that is a beautiful thing. When I think about Facebook, I think about it a little differently than Twitter. We had a meeting with Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook, and, you know, we're saying to her, there are private Facebook accounts and private Instagram accounts that are white supremacists. They are. And we know they exist. But the way your platform is set up is that it's predicated on people reporting. But like, how do you report a private Facebook group? You don't. How do you report a private Instagram page? You don't. And she was like, DeRay, we're going to have AI fix that. And it's like, Cheryl, when? Right? Like, when is that happening? So I worry a lot about the Facebook world. Twitter. With some of Twitter, it's like some people came to Twitter bad. Twitter didn't make them bad. They came bad, they've been bad, they just bad. Twitter's responsibility is to make sure that the bad people don't get to form new communities. And I think they have been a little slower on that than they could have been. I also think that, like, and I've said this to Jack, I've said it to a lot of the leaders there, is that the way they have it set up is that they have representatives of the impacted groups as the people that they hear the feedback from. They need to hear from people who like have received death threats. They need to hear from women who have been assaulted on the platform. Like, they need that more. And I think that would actually change the way they think about the tools.
What do you think about bullying on social media? And how, I mean, that's a problem that a lot of young people have to deal with. And you mentioned bullying in your book as well. Do you have any advice for students who are dealing with that?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I actually am on Twitter a little bit less than I used to be, partly because, you know, people, in 2014, it wasn't clear that people were trying to get famous on the platform. People were just like using it. Now it's like swarms sort of form all of a sudden to try and like make a story trend or take somebody down. And like, that's just like a hard way to be on it. I'm actually not convinced that we were designed to get this much feedback. Like, what does it mean to live in a world where like all day long you're like getting feedback about how people like this or don't like this or what they, and like, that's just like a lot to be in the world. So what I would say to high schoolers, and thank God I didn't have these things in high school, is like, just figure out how to take a break. I say that to myself. I'm like, don't even be on it sometimes, because it's just a lot of feedback. And sometimes if you just don't, I don't know if we're hardwired to like get that much feedback that often.
And so the other part of this was language, and I wanted to ask you about Black Lives Matter. So Black Lives Matter, three words, three very powerful words, but there's no strong consensus, I don't think, about what it is. And you talk a little bit about that in the book. So I wanted to know, you know, for you, is it a mobilizing hashtag? Is it an organization? Is it a credo? What is Black Lives Matter mean to you?
I want it to be all of those things, right? And I'm upset. So the author's note starts with this idea that language is the first act, that the way that power is distributed and redistributed is always through the word. And that it's not that the pen is actually mightier than the sword, but in some ways that the pen is the sword, right? So I'm obsessed with the way that we think about language. We think about even some of the definitions like equality and equity, that equality is everybody gets the same thing. Equity is that people get what they need and deserve. And the work of justice is almost always the work of equity, right? We're never asking for equal funding in school systems. We want equitable funding. We know that it just costs more to educate kids in poverty and kids with special needs. And like, the definitions matter in those places. You think about, I talked about justice and accountability. You think about even diversity and inclusion. Diversity is about bodies, inclusion is about culture. That you can hire 30 more Black people and still be a racist company, right? You can have 20 more trans members and still be a transphobic place. And like, people are doing really well on the diversity and really awful on the inclusion work. And you even think about things like third world. You know, when people are like, that's a third world country, it's like, there is one world, right? That might be a developing country, there's one world. So I'm always interested in the way that language like actually does work, right? That the way we call people things, the way that we label things does work. When I think about Black Lives Matter, I want it to be all of those things. I think it is like a basic fact. I think that it is a call to action. I think it's like an orientation to the world. You know, somebody asked me recently, like, why do we focus on Black people so much and not other people of color? And it's like, I actually don't think it has to be an either or. I think it's like a both and. But the reality is that we know that the disparities are so great for Black people that if we fix it for Black people, we've actually fixed it for everybody else too, right? And that's why we think about it.
For me, some of the most powerful moments in the book are when you speak about your personal experience in your memoir and biography, particularly about being Black and gay. And so, you know, there's this perceived sort of conflict between liberation for LGBTQ and you kind of
the gay mafia.
The gay, yes. Mafia.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean,
I'm not a member of the gay mafia. There is no gay mafia. Sorry about that. That'll be on the news. Deray McKesson, gay mafia. I'm like,
But I mean, I do think there is this perceived conflict between those two missions. Can you just talk a little bit about why that is and how you've encountered it in your work?
Yeah, so, you know, people often are like, the gay mafia thing is one, or like the gay agenda is an even better one. It's like, I'm like, what is the agenda? I haven't been brought into the circle yet. Like, what is the gay agenda? You know, we think about intersectionality. People misunderstand intersectionality often. The intersectionality is not about intersecting identities. It's about intersecting systems of oppression. And like, we know, you know, Gloria Steinem has this great statement where she says, we know that the issues are linked, not ranked. And that like, we need to be fighting on all of the fronts at all of the times, because we know that anytime oppression shows up, like, it creates space for more oppression. Like, that's just the way it works. So, like, I want gay people to be free. I want, you know, trans members of the community to be free. I want straight people to be free. Like, we are fighting for liberation on all of these fronts. I'm always interested in the way that, like, people's homophobia shows up. That people, with me, they'll be like, I'm homophobic, but I like you. And it's like, that doesn't work, right? I don't want to be, like, a safe space for your hate. That's not what I'm signed up for. So I get that a lot, which is interesting. You know, I did write about being gay I've been gay for a long time, way before the book. But I wrote about it because I never, and you know, I sort of came out in the movement, you know, along in 2014. Not that I was ever in the closet. The chapter is called Coming Out of the Quiet. This idea that just because you didn't know doesn't mean it wasn't real. And the reason I wrote about it here, and it's, I was actually saying this to myself the other day, is that this is the first time I've ever sort of written about love, and like what it, this is definitely the first time I've ever written about being gay in any long form since. And the only reason I was reluctant to write about it before is that I've lived a pretty public life for most of my life, mostly because of student government. And, you know, I was a president of my middle school and high school and college. So I always had this different relationship with my peers. But love was the only thing that was just mine, right? It was like the only thing that I felt like I never had to share with everybody and talk about all the time and da-da-da-da-da. But now I've done it, so you have everything. You have everything. But that was what made that chapter hard, if there was any hard part. I also write about my mother. So my mother left when I was 3 and came back when I was 30. And this is the first time I've ever written about it. So both of those were like the hard chapters to do, partly because those were two things that like were just mine. Like, I didn't feel like I had to share them. I didn't feel like I had to talk to them. But in this moment, I wanted to think about like how they actually matter to the way I show up in the work. And I know that I show up in every room as a gay black man every single day, in every space, every time. So it'd be impossible to write about this, about the journey and about the lessons I've learned without being true to that. And I also know with my mother, and you know, I'll leave it to you to ask a question, but I will just say, I know that with my mother, her leaving, both my parents were addicted to drugs and my mother left when I was 3, is that her absence always made me think about what it meant to be worthy. And I've had a hard, like, last 4 days for some other stuff. And only recently have I ever been angry with her. Like, I'm not angry in the book with her. I'm sort of like, I need to figure it out. But I was angry the other day because I woke up and I just wanted a mother, right? I just wanted a hug and a kiss. I wanted a place that I knew love lived. And, like, I don't have it in that way. And I know that, like, her leaving has always shaped the way that I think about my own work, that if she could leave, anybody could leave, right? That like everything sort of seems a little transitory. So I, as an adult, have had to figure out how to like love people and not hurt them because of her, like, or because of her absence, or because of the way that I think and have internalized my own worth. And I write about that. And the rest of the chapter is about sort of memory and the power of memory and how memory can be both a tool and a weapon.
I think you should describe the quiet a little bit more. You use this extended metaphor in the book, and I think it's really important. It's sort of, you know, not coming out of the closet, coming out of the quiet. I thought it was really powerful, and I wondered.
Thank you. Read that chapter, so I won't give you everything, but read the chapter, because you got a book. You know, I was trying to, like, somebody was like, Dre, when did you come out of the closet? And it's like, really, I remember, I was like, I was the only person in love in this relationship in college, which was the problem. But I called my father for advice, and I'll never forget it. I'm like, Daddy, da-da-da-da-da. And like, and just in the middle of the conversation, it like, it's a guy, right? Like, I don't make this grand announcement. I'm like, yeah, Daddy, he da-da-da. And my father has this moment where he like pauses, and then we just like pick back up, and like that was it, right? Like that was like how it happened. And thank you, Daddy. That was good. That was a good moment. But I never had this like grand coming out. It was like, it was just real. And just because other people didn't know didn't mean it wasn't real. And I think about like this notion that there are a lot of us living in the quiet, and like we have been true in the spaces we're in, but like in the book, there's this metaphor of like being in the library, that the world for so many of us is this place that we've been told that like the more quiet we are is the only way to get the work done. and that like we have to be quiet because that's just one of the rules, and like being quiet actually allows us to access knowledge and information. And that part of what we did in protest, part of what we do when we show up in the fullness of who we are, is that we shatter this idea that the only way to build things, the only way to be in community with each other, the only way to like access information is to hide parts of who we are. And like shattering the idea that the library is how we build community in quietness. And like that's sort of what the chapter tries to frame out. It was this talk that I gave 3 years ago that was about coming out of the quiet. And like, what does it mean that there are all these voices that are always whispering in communities, just waiting for somebody to say, speak louder? And part of our work as organizers is to remind people that they can speak louder and that we will create space that is safe for them and that acknowledges their voice at every step of the way.
I wanted to just give a shout out to Baird Rustin too, and all of the people who we don't really learn about in school, but who are influencing, you know, who helped, who are change makers essentially. And I just thought it would be good for you to share how he influenced your life.
Yeah, so Rustin, you know, if you ever read Rustin's work, Rustin was like the chief architect of the March on Washington, all these other things. His work is like not very flowery, like we're used to when we read the civil rights, the old civil rights folks. It is very pragmatic and like you just take it away. So you read his critiques of Malcolm and he's just like, Malcolm, I like you, you don't have a plan, I don't understand, right? Like it's just like, that is like how it's like not a whole lot. Like it's not a whole lot of rapping. It just sort of like gets to the point. You're like, thank you, Baird Rustin. I also think about him in the sense of, you know, people ask me, and this is like Rustin sort of inspired me to think about this. People will ask me often, like, what am I doing to reach across the aisle? And I always think about, like, I'm not necessarily reaching across the aisle. That's like not a part of my work at the moment. I'm always interested in how do we build the biggest choir? I want to build the single biggest choir that, like, if any of you have ever been in a choir before, you know that, especially a church choir, you know that being in the choir is a whole lot of work, that nothing about being in the choir is a passive experience, that it takes a lot of work to show up for rehearsal, to learn the music, to sing in the best way possible. And so much of our work is to say, like, we are building the biggest choir, that we are finding people in congregations and in groups who have voices who don't yet believe in them, but like they can sing. And part of our work is to remind people, you can sing, you have a voice. I want you to do it with me so we can sing the best song possible. I want you to teach me music. I want us to sing a song that does more than just, it's like, that does more than just like is a hum and a murmur, but like changes the way people feel and show up in community. And like when I think about Rustin, he reminds me that what the best organizers do is to go into places and say, you have a voice. You had a voice before I got here. And I'm trying to help you join a choir so you can sing a bigger song. And like that to me is a part of the work. That like, what the best teachers do is walk into classrooms and say, you already had the gift before I got here. What I'm supposed to do is help you find the gift every single day after I'm gone. What the worst teachers do is make people believe that the gift only exists in their presence. And like as organizers, we say to you, the gift, you already got it. I just want you to find it and use it every single day. And that to me, I was inspired to think about those things because of Rustin.
So I want to return to the subject of trauma, which is something I think a lot about when, for race-related, when editing race-related, because, you know, uplift is also part of the Black experience, but there is a lot of tragedy, and finding a balance, I think, is really important for health and well-being. And in the book, you talk about being suicidal. You talk about sleeping in a closet because you wanted your parents to think you had run away. And you talk about sexual predation. And you go to therapy, and you say that therapy didn't work for you. And I was curious to know, did you end up going back to therapy? A, this is a two-parter. And then the second part of the question is, how do you mitigate that? Like, just talking about race can be very traumatic for a lot of Jim Crow, slavery, rape. you know, violence, it could be very traumatic. So I wanted to know how you mitigate that in your daily life.
Yeah, so just for context, like, these stories are stories from when I was a kid. So not that therapy didn't work, but I think therapy's a good thing. Everybody should be in therapy. Therapy. When I was a kid, like, everybody, get your therapy. When I was a kid, I write about in the book about being molested, and I got taken, I was in therapy for a little bit, and it was this thing that I didn't tell my father for, like, a whole set of years. So by the time I went to therapy, that therapist wasn't equipped to help me think about, like, solutions. She just wanted me to reprocess things, and, like, I just wasn't, like, I'd already done a lot of the processing, so I didn't need to do that in that moment. So later, I figured out how to, like, think about solutions in a way, but it wasn't, like, therapy's an important thing. So when I think about trauma, I'm mindful that so many of us live in worlds of trauma, like, that is real. So much of this work is about trauma. You know, people, I get a lot of emails being like, why don't you post more on Instagram about the movement? And it's like, I deal with death all day long. Instagram is like the one place that I just want it to be like a little bit of joy, right? Like, that is like my last little reserve of joy. So not that I don't believe that like justice shouldn't be there, but like I need something that isn't like death and dying all day. And like Instagram is my little place. So when I think about like how I cope, it's like the basic things. I need like a room with four walls and a door, and I'm like, I can recharge. I started watching The Ozarks, which is interesting. I used to read a little bit more.
I don't know that show. What is
the
it
about? The Ozarks, yeah. It's on Netflix. Plug for Netflix. I'm kidding, I'm not paid by Netflix. That'll be like the next room, right? It'll be like, Duran McKesson paid by Netflix. I'm not paid by Netflix. So yeah, I like need some of the basic things like in this. You know, I will say one of the things that I'm most interested in at this point is how do we think about the trauma that people don't know? So like in the book, in the chapter around the police, we did a lot of work around uncovering things that like people didn't know. So like in California, there's a law that says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline regardless of the findings. That doesn't make any sense. In Cleveland, they destroy police officer disciplinary records every 2 years. That doesn't make any sense. In Maryland, there's a law that says that you can file an anonymous complaint against an officer for everything except brutality. That also doesn't make any sense, right? So some of this is like, how do we start to peel back the layers of things that actually almost guarantee that we will never hold people accountable? And like, I'm fascinated by that. I'm also fascinated, and I'll ask you, I'll put you on the spot. I'm fascinated by lead, and I know there's a lead issue here in Portland because I was at the high school today and they were like, lead is here. And I'm like, okay. Do you know why kids eat lead paint chips? Like, why kids have been eating lead paint chips over like years?
No.
No. Maybe you know this. I just learned this. I'm like obsessed. Because it's sweet. Yes, because lead is sweet. Lead is naturally sweet. And why that matters is that there have been so many years of like statements being like, those parents just didn't care about their kids. They letting them eat paint chips. That's why the kids licking the walls, because the parents don't care. And it's like, no, like it actually is sweet, right? And if I didn't think there was a conspiracy before, when you couple that with like the housing administration literally mandating that housing projects use lead-based paint for a certain set of years, it's like that is trauma, right? And we know that there's no cure for lead, that the best that we can do is put kids in therapy, and some of the therapies can be really productive, but like that actually does real damage. You know, you even think about Flint, is that Flint has had one of the biggest declines in recorded literacy rates that we've ever seen in this country. And like, what does that mean for the way we think about the work? I have a podcast. On the podcast, I'm also obsessed with this. I'm obsessed with, if I wasn't doing work around the police and mass incarceration, I would be full-time lead. I'm like obsessed with lead. The second is, I didn't know that all the teeth you get aren't baby teeth. I just like didn't know that. That like when your molars come in around 5 and 6, that they're permanent. Like parents probably know that. I didn't know that. And that some of the work around dental justice is like helping parents, especially in rural communities where they just don't have access to a dentist, or low-income communities, get their kids' teeth sealed. Like that can actually have a huge impact, and like all this work. And we did it on the podcast, and like we got all these emails from parents being like, I just got my kids' teeth sealed. And we're like, go seal their teeth. You know, there's all these things that like people just never knew. I didn't know that people didn't know. And the last thing I'll say is I was emailing recently with somebody who's incarcerated. And every single time I email him, I have to buy an electronic stamp. And I'm like, if there is not a scam in the world, this is a scam, right? And the number of stamps that I have to buy is predicated on how long the emails are. And I'm like, okay, super scam. This is like scamtastic. And then I have to buy him a stamp so he can write me back. I'm like, okay, this is a racket, right? And how do we give life and like light to those things, right? That is like a different way that trauma is working that often doesn't make the news, isn't in anybody's book, but actually is like a huge impact on the way that people think about being community and certainly the way that people think about justice.
You mentioned the midterms. Some journalists are arguing it'll be one of the most important elections of our lifetime. And so I wanted to talk about incremental reform versus sort of tearing the whole thing down. Some people feel incremental reform is sort of a waste of time. What are your thoughts on incremental reform and versus sort of more radical approaches to social justice?
You know, I'm always reminded that they rewrote the tax code on the back of scrap paper. So if they can rewrite the tax code on the back of scrap paper, we can do all this stuff pretty quickly too, right? That like, don't tell me that like mass incarceration has to be a three-generation solution. Like they literally did the biggest rewrite of the tax code on napkins and paper towels and scrap paper. Like that's wild. So like, I'm always reminded of that. And like also reminded that like when people talk about burn it down, that like when it all burns down, we actually don't start from the Garden of Eden, we start from the ashes. And some people don't win when the ashes are where we start from. What I do believe though is that when we say the system is broken, some people say, oh, it was designed to be that way. And my takeaway from that is that it was designed, right? People made this up, and because people made it up, I think that we can make up something better. Like I believe that. And like that carries me. So you think about like in Florida to this day, theft over $300 is a felony. And in Florida, when you become a felon, you permanently lose the right to vote. So like, imagine stealing like a bike at 18 and forever losing the right to vote. That's like a wild thing. But like some random person sat down and was like $300. And you're like, people made this up. This is not like some divine, God didn't say like earth man $300, right? That like, people made this up, and because people made it up, we can actually like make up something different. And like that is like what I believe. When we think about reform and revolution is that the good reform is saying that there are people impacted by the system today, and we need to do something to help them out today. So when I'm fighting to like make it so I can email somebody who's incarcerated and like it doesn't cost money, that I know is not the same thing as getting him out of prison. I get it. It is about saying that I can do something today that makes it like less difficult. While at the same time, I'm like, free everybody, right? That like, the system is so corrupt that this like doesn't actually make sense as a solution, and it's not actually making communities any safer, that this is like a both and, not an either or.
On that note, I wanted to ask if you agree with Jared Kushner's sort of back end prison reform policies.
No.
Okay.
And like, here's what I'll say is that like, Sessions is calling for the death penalty for drug dealers. You know, so you're like, I don't believe anything coming out of this whole
administration.
Okay. And you know, when I do think about 2020, is that I've been thinking a lot about like who's gonna run and like who can win. And the best that I have to say now is that like whoever will beat Trump in 2020 won't be running against Trump. They'll be running for a vision of America that's bigger than him.
All right.
And that, like, if you run against Trump, you're only as big as Trump, and we need somebody, like, bigger than that. So I'm hopeful about 2020.
All right, it's time for Q&A, audience Q&A. So I've got a couple questions here. This one I thought was great. Who is your dream guest on Pod Save the People?
Let me think. I had Ocasio-Cortez and she was amazing. Like she was as amazing as you want her to be. You know, I talked to Hillary in Cleveland before the election And Hillary was excellent. Like, she really was. Like, when I think about, like, Bernie and Hillary, one of the things, I think that Bernie sort of figured out the what. He figured out how to paint a picture of, like, what the world could be. The how was a little shaky, but, like, he had the what down, right? I think that Hillary figured out the how, and, like, the what was a little shaky, right? Like, the plan, her plan made a lot of sense. I think that she couldn't always deliver that in a way that resonated with people. But we met with her once, and, like, we met her twice, but the second time, she was really, really good, like, really good. And I wish that people had heard her. So I'd love to have her on the pod.
Why do you think that you write about this, that second meeting in the book, and why do you think that she made the decision, or her team made the decision, not to release the recording of that meeting?
Yeah, so we asked her team, like, we're going to meet with her. Can we record it so we can release it? And I don't know, you know, we asked her, like, do you think the police should deserve, like, need more money? And she was like, no. We were like, really? she was like, no, they have enough money. We can do other things. And we were like, I mean, it was just like a really, really good conversation. And we were about those things because some of the consequences of, like, people being like, we should invest in police training, which, like, train everybody, like, yes, is that we don't think that it should come with, like, another $50 million, right? Like, that's not a solution. And some of the training stuff, I will push and say, like, I don't know what a training module looks like to not kill a 10-year-old. Like, I don't know what that training looks like, right? That some of this stuff is just pretty basic. And, like, even with, like, unconscious bias, you know, we asked her about that stuff. It's like, I'm all for unconscious bias training. Some of this bias, though, seems pretty conscious to me, right? That, like, I don't know how unconscious it was that the woman called the police on the two black guys in Starbucks. That seemed pretty conscious, right? So how do we not let people off the hook for some of these things, too? And she was, like, just really good. I was, like, very impressed with, like, her in that meeting, and I would love to have her on the pod.
Some great questions. DeRay, when you're not working so hard and have downtime, how do you recover back 100%? This is from Coach Christie.
Hey, Coach. I'm kidding. I don't know you. Hi, Coach. Hey, Coach. At this point, I want to be around people that I've known for a long time. I travel a lot. I'm in a lot of new communities, and I'm thankful. My downtime, I'm like FaceTiming my friends. I'm like, I just got Marco Polo. I feel like an old man being like, I just downloaded Marco Polo. But I did. And like my niece and nephew send Marco Polo videos and they're adorable. So like, I'm all about doing that sort of stuff. I really love surprises. So I like to surprise people. My sister's a principal in elementary school. And I just sent her this like ridiculously big edible arrangement in the middle of the day just because I knew it'd be like a thing in the office. So like, I like doing those sort of things. I have to think about I haven't told her this yet because you can't tell people about surprises, so don't tell her if you know her, is that I think I'm gonna start sending things to school every week just because, like, I think that's fun. I'm gonna send balloons, like 100 balloons to the office. It's gonna drive her nuts. I'm excited, so.
With this first book honoring voices of a new generation of activists, what are your thoughts on strengthening an intergenerational movement?
Yeah, so we know there were a lot of people on the streets and there are a lot of people at the table. It has gotten better. Think about 2014. People wanted to be our parents and not our peers, right? And I don't need another father. He's good, right? And I think it's important that we remember that we can show up in rooms and, like, it doesn't matter how old you are for you to be able to contribute, like, a really thoughtful idea. And I've been in meetings with 14-year-olds that have pushed and challenged in thoughtful ways. I've been in meetings with 80-year-olds who have pushed and challenged in thoughtful ways. 12-year-olds, 18-year-olds, right? And, like, age isn't the defining characteristic of whether somebody is, like, able to push and challenge. So I believe that. I've been in a lot of rooms that show that, you know. And when we think about, like, respectability politics, I wear the same thing every day. It's, like, a pretty basic, you know, I wake up, put on a shirt, a vest, some pants. And when I went to the White House, people were like, Dre, why didn't you wear a suit today? It's like, the suit didn't make me smarter, right? Like, I'm, like, not, I didn't, like, learn all these things about the police because I had a suit on. And there are a lot of people who, like, especially in an older generation, that think that, like, that is the marker of, like, whether you are strong or smart or able. And, like, we have to do more work to dismantle those things.
What keeps you moving forward when your friends and family are over hearing about justice and human rights issues?
You know, I think that part of this work is how do we create different hooks for people that, like, what really good organizers do is that they know that, A, they aren't always the best entrance for people, so I get it. I'm not always the best storyteller for you. Like, part of what I can do, though, is try and put you in a place where you get the best storyteller for you. But the second is that, like, we got to figure out how to always make hooks for people. So my bar is always, like, can I explain this to my aunt? Like, if I can't tell Aunt Meek about it, then it doesn't matter. That's, like, my bar. And not because Aunt Meek isn't smart, but she just isn't in front of CNN all day. And, like, so when I talk to her about Kavanaugh, I'm not entering being like, Aunt Meek, did you hear about Roe v. Wade? Because that's just not her entrance. I'm like, Aunt Meek, they are trying to hide the papers. And she's like, they trying to hide the papers? I'm like, girl, they hiding the papers. That's crazy. And she's like, they can't hide the papers, Durant. I'm like, they can't hide the papers. And, like, that is my hook for Aunt Meek, right? And once I get her hooked on the papers, then I can be like, and he don't even believe in a woman's right to choose. And she's like, DeRay. I'm like, I know, right? Like, and that is, and, like, part of our work is to create these interests. People ask me about the police a lot, and it's like, I know that starting with, like, we can live in a world without the police, freaks some people out. I get it, right? So, like, that's not always the best place to start with people. Is that I'm mindful that, like, what is also true is that for 2,000 years, we slit people's wrists, let their blood, let them bleed out, and we call that healthcare. We were like, oh, it's like draining the impurities. You're like, no, you're killing them, right? Like, and they're like, oh, their blood pressure went down. You're like, yeah, because there's no blood. Like, this wasn't a solution. And I say that because, like, it took the medical community to, like, reflect and say, yeah, we've been doing this for 2,000 years, but, like, it actually doesn't work. And that's sort of how I think about policing, is that, like, yeah, we've been doing it for a long time, but, like, we should be open to questioning. And, like, I was on a panel with an officer once, and she said, DeRay, the world is hard. Like, people commit crimes. Like, are you saying the police should never kill somebody? And I say to her, like, when should the police kill your child? And she's like, I don't know. I'm like, well, I don't know either, right? Like, if you don't know, I don't know. And part of our work is to, like, put the cognitive burden on other people, too, to make them think a little deeper about the world. And, you know, people will press me on Mike Brown, and they'll be like, I don't know if he had his hands up. That was a lie. Da, da, da. And I'm like, here's the thing. I wasn't there. What I do know, though, or what I'll ask you is, do you think that the penalty for jaywalking is death? Like, do you think that, you know, and putting those things to people, or, like, what does a 4-year-old have to do to earn dinner? What does a 7-year-old have to do to earn shelter, right? Like, some of our work is, like, putting the onus back on other people so that they start thinking deeper. That so often in this work, when we are morally right about these issues, we just start preaching, right? And when people get tired, is that they get tired of being preached at. And I get that. So some of our best strategies are, like, using either a hook or a question that, like, make other people do a little bit more work than they're doing.
That was DeRay McKesson in conversation with Loretta Charlton at the Arlene Schitzer Concert Hall in September 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Ligori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.